There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly. You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
46% of Americans expect to leave behind financial obligations when they pass away. So it's crucial to make sure your family is financially protected. Policy Genius helps you find the right life insurance coverage by comparing options from America's top insurers with help from licensed, award-winning agents. Secure your financial future with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get free life insurance quotes in just a few clicks. That's policygenius.com.
My name is Clay Newcomb, and I'm the host of the Bear Hunting Magazine podcast. I'll also be your host into the world of hunting, the icon of North American wilderness, the bear. We'll talk about tactics, gear, conservation, but we'll also bring you into some of the wildest country on the planet, chasing bear. This week on the Bear Hunting Magazine podcast, we're taking a look back the last 2.5 years, and we're going to have some highlights from our conversations with the incredible people that we've had as guests on this show. This isn't all the highlights. There just wasn't a way to include every special moment, every special conversation, but this was some of them. I really think you're going to enjoy this podcast. And you'll be able to go back and listen to these full episodes if you want to. It's winter time, and it's time to get the dogs out. We've been squirrel hunting and coon hunting even this week. And if you need dog stuff, you really need to support our guys at W Hunting Supply. But don't do it for them and don't do it for me. Do it for yourself, because the selection they have, the customer service that they have down there is top notch. These people are houndsmen. People you're going to be talking to and dealing with are houndsmen, or just order online. Buddy Woodbury and his team, they're masters at the Garmin products. They've got the new Garmin Alpha 200i, which is Garmin's new, most recent dog tracking system. Check it out, W Hunting Supply. Northwoods Bear Products. Man, if you're baiting bears, you got to be using this stuff. Spring is coming. I know nobody's really thinking about baiting bears right now, but you can and you should. And when you do, Northwoods Bear Products, check them out. CVA Muzzleloaders, they make an incredible line of muzzleloaders. They have an incredible guarantee. If you're going to be muzzleloader hunting, check out CVA. I've been carrying one this year. Some of you have heard a few of my stories about carrying them. And I've learned a lot about muzzleloaders this year. And I truly love carrying, love shooting my CVA Acura mountain rifle. Check out CVA and all that they have to offer. Check them out. Western Bear Foundation. These boys are doing some good stuff out west, speaking on behalf of bear hunters, bear lovers. That's us. We're bear lovers. Joe Condellis and his team at the Western Bear Foundation are doing a great job. They're a nonprofit hunting conservation organization, membership driven. Check out their organization, become a member. This first excerpt was taken from episode 21. The episode was called Old Mountain Hunter, Ora Lee Province. This conversation that I had with Ori was one of my favorites of all time. since the recording of this podcast, Ori Lee has passed away, but this was a very unique conversation. Well, give me just a little, like, kind of a bigger glimpse of your life. So, born in 1927, dad was a logger, and you grew up just, you stepped right into the family business and just logged right with him.
Yeah.
And then, so you did that until when, and what other kind of occupations did you have?
Well, my dad died in 44, but
okay.
In 41, while the World War II broke out, and my brothers, three of them, went in service.
Okay.
And I was the oldest one left at home.
Okay.
And I took care of my mother and my nephew and two sisters and a brother.
Hmm.
Yep.
So you were just a few years too young to be drafted into the war.
I was. I was when my dad died, I was 16.
Okay.
And when I become 18, the day I was 18, the day after I was 18, my birthday come on Sunday that year. On Monday, I registered, and I went down and passed the examination. 8th day of July, I got my call for examination, went down and passed, and 8th day of August, got my call for service. And a minister's out here, and I had a big tomato crop out, about 10 acres of tomatoes, and me and the family did. We had to have something to live on. And but anyway, while there's a minister out there, he said, this boy needs to take care of his mother and these children.
Mm.
And so he wrote, I got deferred until till October the 15th. And in other words, so the crop was over.
Yeah.
Then I still got my 1A classification, but the war was over at that time.
Oh, wow. So you just barely missed it.
I just barely missed
so
it.
So what year would that have been, 1944?
Well, let's see, it'd been about 47.
Well, I can't do the math. Either.
47, I believe, or something.
Okay,
like that.
Okay, 40. That would have been seven, when World War II was over.
47, right, somewhere along there.
Yeah. I'll be darned.
46. It's over in 46, the war was.
Wow. So you would have gone if the war would have...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the boys that I went to school with, some of them, they was in there. They went to Germany.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
Yep.
Wow. So so you logged up until how old were you? Well, you grew tomatoes, you did some farming, you had some cattle.
Right. Like, well, I couldn't work in timber. That was the main line up till years and years later.
Yeah.
But anyway, I went and me and my brother, we that he never did have to go to war, and but me and him went and cut timber and logged it. Yeah. I hauled it on a wagon.
Yeah.
And he skidded it out, and I went and hauled it.
Mm.
And dumped it off at the mill.
Mm.
And that was, I forgot now what year that was. It's about in the late 40s anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the Great Depression, you were just a kid during
Great
Depression. Now, these hills weren't really, I mean, they were affected by the Great Depression, but people were already poor.
Yeah.
I mean, there wasn't much you could do to somebody that was just living off the land, basically, when it comes to economic stress. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. But we lived off the land.
Yeah.
In 1936, that was a dry year, you know.
Okay.
And we had a tomato crop, and we hauled water and set them out. And they got up, and just the blooming and everything turned off dry. We never got a tomato.
Mm.
In 1936.
Wow.
And
that was hard to take.
Yeah. But anyway, I remember that well, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we worked in a timber, and, you know, the people back then, they finally got where they brought out food stamps and things, but we never got any. My dad just wouldn't have nothing to do with that.
Really? Just by principle.
That's
he
right.
didn't need any
but
help.
We made it. We made it without it. We worked and never made it.
Yeah. What would have been a normal meal for your family back then when you were a kid?
Oh, had plenty to eat.
Yeah.
Had plenty to eat.
Yeah.
We had anything that.
Yeah.
Just about. We canned.
I guess you raised hogs and we canned
hogs.
Vegetables.
Yeah.
Had a garden. I know you still have a garden, don't you?
Well, yeah.
Or
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We made it fine.
Wow.
Done good.
Yeah.
I had about 30 swarms of bees back during the war while you couldn't get sugar. Food is all rationed. You couldn't buy nothing. Everybody's out of sugar, and I had bees, and we got to, you could get to, from it to feed the bees, you know, because it used the honey some way or another in guns.
Is that right?
Powder, yeah. I don't know just what, but that's what I heard.
Huh.
Anyway. But
so you were selling honey?
Well, I didn't sell it, but we eat it.
Okay, you just had it.
Yeah, we had it, and we got plenty of sugar to feed the bees, and so we didn't have to run out of sugar. A lot of people never had no sugar, flour, or anything. They couldn't give just so much.
Huh.
You couldn't buy a truck tar or nothing.
Really?
Not a pair of shoes, hardly.
Wow.
Yeah.
The next excerpt is my conversation with Roy Clark over in East Tennessee. This is episode 67, and it's called Appalachian Hound Hunting with Roy Clark, Part 1. Mr. Roy is a special guy. He's very dear to me. He's a master bear hound breeder and just a relic over there in the Appalachian Mountains. It's a pretty incredible thing, and it's a unique, you know, there's a unique social structure that happens inside of, like, what I see coming from the outside in, looking at you guys. I mean, just the relationships that you guys have, and I mean, if you go bear hunting with you see what it's all about. I mean, from daylight till dark, how many days a year are you guys together, and you're working together to accomplish a goal? And then now Scott is over here every day helping Roy with the dogs and stuff. Now, that's a whole nother side of the thing, is just keeping dogs year-round, you know. I mean, that's a lot of work in and of itself. But
yeah, it's a ton of work. It's a ton of work, yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, that's something that all of us at some point have taken our turn. You know, Scott's taking jobs out on the road, and it'd be me or Matthew or whoever, and that's the thing that – you know, we've always took a lot of pride in was the dogs. And that's, you know, we're always talking about catching bears on the ground, and Matthew and one of the things that we're always looking out for is protecting those dogs, because that's our lifeline. You know, there is no bear hunting for us without that pack of dogs. So one of the most important things to us when we go into one of those bears is watching out for them and doing our job to take care of them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's our main priority is the dogs first, then whatever comes out of that, you know, we handle it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Making sure the dogs are tied up before any bears are shot out of the trees, and you know,
right,
all that stuff. So
yeah,
if we ain't got them dogs, we ain't catching no bird.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Mr. Roy, why don't you tell me about how your dad? Well, just your first memories of bear hunting. Of going back in the mountains.
Alvin and David, right, those hunted with us. Or how old are you, Al?
54.
54 years, ever since he's been big enough to go. And his daddy hunted with us. And his daddy, like my daddy, like Josh, liked me. His daddy did. And he hunted. And we went to school together up here, and it's in there somewhere. I've got a Valentine's card in there that he sent me when we was about in the fourth grade, I think. And on that Valentine's card he sent me, he said, "We bear hunters, ain't we, Roy?" That was his dad.
Alvin David's dad.
Yeah, his dad.
He said, "We bear hunters, aren't we,
Roy?" We bear
Roy?
Hunters, buddy.
And what grade would you, how old would you have been?
We was in the fourth grade, so ever when that was. How long ago would that so be?
About 9 years old, bro.
Yeah.
Nine, something like that.
So you went ahead and just stuck with that identity, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, his daddy sort of left us coming and went some. He's back now. Maybe he'll stay. But that boy right yonder ain't never fired today, buddy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I love him. I'm getting of it, too.
Yep.
That just shows you, Clay, what it means to us. You know, it's beyond just going out and having a big time hunting.
Yeah.
It's beyond just a group of guys here hanging out in Roy's house. You know, it's our life.
Yeah.
You know, it's something we've all grown up doing all the way back through, and it's just it's a bond.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is. It really is.
Son, he won't leave you, buddy. He won't leave you out there. I don't care how long you have to stay.
Yeah.
Leave you or the dogs. He'd be the last one to come. He'd be the last one there helping you get the last dog up.
Well, you know, I've hunted with you guys for 3 days of the last 68 years this guy's been bear hunting. And the one time we had to fetch dogs after dark, he went. I knew that.
Yep.
Yeah,
we've spent a long nights in the truck together and stayed all night and freezing cold and whatever. We stay there with those dogs.
Yeah. Episode 87 is for sure dear to my heart. I had some of my close friends in the room with me, and it was called Beginner's Guide to Building Your Family on Purpose. We talked about building families, the transfer of family values into our children, really stuff that's super important to me. All this testing. So what we're talking about is building family culture. Building family culture. And all you guys, I respect all of you for the way that you have built your families. And I think nobody's doing everything right. I mean, that the word right is a tough one, but we're doing it intentionally. And I know all you guys well enough to know that you're very intentionally building family culture. And if you don't hear anything else on this podcast and, you know, you're just listening to this and like you just want to chew on something, my question to you is, are you being intentional with the way that you're building your family? And that word building could throw you off. And let me say this right here is that, or I've got a couple of written statements here. Let's see. We research and consult almost everything that we want to be proficient at.
Mm-hmm.
Do we not?
Oh, yeah.
Like if you're going to go on a big hunting trip, you're going to learn about it. Yeah. If you want to get into cycling, like you go to cycling experts and see what they say.
Right.
But with family stuff, a lot of times people are really isolated. Why do you think that is?
I think it can be perceived as weakness to have to rely on on advice or counsel from someone else to build your own family.
Yeah.
You know, when you see, you know, someone who's proficient at hunting and you see, you know, I like to fly fish. And so, you know, I watch other guys. It's like, well, they've had a long history of this and I want to glean from them. But when it comes to your own family, it's a really a sensitive spot because you don't want to be seen as weak.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or there's the other side of you get isolated because you don't want to build like mom and dad, or you don't want to follow their pattern.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do it on my own. I'm going to find my own way. And so it's almost a comparison of, I don't want to do that, so I'm going to do it my own way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that can make you isolated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think we as people a lot of times are insecure, and to open ourselves up for somebody else's input, that's pretty vulnerable.
Yeah.
And it takes time of doing that a lot that you learn the value of it.
Yeah.
And you're like, man, the more I open up my life to input, the better my life gets. The more I learn, the better my marriage gets. And so I remember even early on in my marriage, and then same with early on when I first had kids, like maybe like the first time I kind of like went to maybe one of you guys or, you know, people older than me that have been married longer, had kids longer. I remember it was almost like, you know, what are they going to say? And like, what if I'm doing everything wrong? And
what if I'm invalidated by what they say?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then every time that I did go to people wiser than me, I always got two things. I always got, number one, they related to me. I've never had an issue in my family or marriage. Somebody was like, you struggle with that? Oh my gosh. Like, you're a terrible person. Like, you have a marital struggle? Are you serious? Yeah. It's like everything. It's almost like my friends would like fill in the sentence. Oh yeah. And I bet you said this after you did that. Yeah, that's it. And then I bet you felt like this. Yeah. And so that was one. That right there is comforting.
Yeah.
And it shows it you is. That it's safe. And then the second
thing. Because you're looking at somebody that you perceive has made it through that. And you're like, well, they're okay.
Yeah.
And they had this problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the second thing is I've always from that received an alternative perspective that I didn't have before.
Yes.
And it's like every single time I learned that I can't do this on my own, you know, and I know I'm jumping right into all this, but like, that's one thing I learned with building my family is like, there ain't no way I can do this on my own. So
that's not weakness.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I think it's like this double-edged sword. It's like, we're kind of insecure, but we kind of want to do it on our own. But at the same time, that's really hard. So we ended up just kind of I think people either just feel like a failure or they just kind of build up. They kind of just say, well, this is how I am. And this is the way my family's going to be forever. Not really getting to experience what could be better.
Yeah. I think it's a pretty American cultural thing to be really independent with your family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just, you know, cultures are built based upon national history.
Yep.
I mean, and like, you think about the people that like settled in this region or heck, every region of this country, unless they're Native Americans, they came here and there was like this pioneer spirit that was on people to like bust through the wilderness and make it on their own. People had to be self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. And like here in the Ozarks, that is a trait that is honored, self-sufficiency. I mean, like at the Newcomb Farm, we hat tip to the idea of self-sufficiency big time. That's okay. But that cannot be the definer of every part of your life or you're a fool.
Uh-huh.
You know? So like, yeah, we like to hunt some of our own food, butcher our own animals, grow some stuff, train our, you know. But when it comes to things that I am not an expert on, that I'm incapable, well, anybody can have insight into their family and make decisions on their own. We're not suggesting that somebody is incapable of making decisions on their own.
No.
But what I'm saying is best practice inside of life is for people to be connected inside of some network of people that they trust,
mm-hmm.
you know. Episode 91 is one that I'll never forget. It was a conversation that I had with Jonathan Wilkins. The title of the podcast was The History of Racism in African American Hunting. This is a unique conversation. Man, you know, there's what you just said about African Americans being so connected rurally for such a long time has almost been like erased from the culture in a lot of ways. I heard a stat today that there's 300,000 African Americans that hunt in the U.S. today. 300,000 of like 11 million hunters. So less than 1 in 10. Does that stat ring with you?
I mean,
I heard that from a 2017.
I'd believe that if you took that nationally. Now, I'd say I would hazard a guess that the bulk of black hunters are in the South.
Yeah.
But yeah, I bet if you, you know, if you look at the centers of African American life in this country, they're going to be mostly in coastal or northern cities, you know, that, and these are population remnants of the Great Migration.
Right.
You know, people leaving, structural racism and, you know, physical violence in the South,
which and they moved to the and they to moved the cities.
To the industrial cities of the North, because you know you also had a you had an economic shift out of agriculture into production, and those production centers were in the North. So you had these waves of people moving to, you know, St. Louis. Like my dad's family was originally from Keogh, Arkansas.
Really, you know,
that's about 30 miles away from here, but you know I'm from St. Louis. Indianapolis, Detroit, Minneapolis, Baltimore. Mm-hmm. You know, these were big industrial, Boston, big industrial cities that black people moved up to. And it shows you kind of how short our collective memory is.
Yes.
Because, you know, just colloquially, you start to think that, you know, that, I don't know, that maybe there's something inherent in blackness that that is disassociative with the natural world.
Right.
And if you just look back a little bit further, or you just you drive around like the state that we live in. Like, you know, you live in a part of the state where there's not very many African Americans. If you drove over to the opposite side of the state, you would see black people everywhere. You would see whole towns. I mean, now small, you'd see small towns, but like Cotton Plant, which is about 10 miles from Brinkley, like, is probably almost entirely African American.
And that's all remnant of.
Yeah, that's agricultural slavery. Populations, where people lived. And, you know, and it's like you probably most people wouldn't think of black farmers, but across the Delta, across the South, there are black farmers. There are, you know, multi-generational black farmers. I don't know, man. Well, that's a good place to put a button.
The
in
rich, what I was shocked at, Jonathan, inside of this book, in the first chapter, is like, I mean, just is if somebody could just even just read the first chapter of this book, the rich history of hunting that was built upon kind of this plantation model, if I don't know another way to say it.
Yeah, for sure.
But like the black people were in charge of, there was a lot of hound hunting, a lot of dog hunting. They were running deer. They were running rabbits. They were, well, and so a lot of the black guys were the hound handlers, and a lot of them were master houndsmen. I mean, that blows my mind. The next section is from episode 73, titled How Bear Hunters and Hillbillies Defined the State. It was a conversation with Dr. Brooks Blevins. He's a historian. He's a serial book writer. He's written so many books about history in the Ozarks. And that conversation, I just loved it to the core. You're going to enjoy this segment. Just this being their natural historic range. I mean, it's just this incredible animal. And with that incredible animal comes all this incredible history. So there's been this like resurgence of the idea of the Ozarks being a place to hunt bear. And a lot of that happened, and it's really happened in the last 20 years as the bear populations have increased in the Ozarks. Right. And so the hunting regulations have liberalized in order to, you know, manage bear populations. So all of a sudden guys are able to hunt bears in a fashion where they can actually harvest them, kind of liberalize the seasons a little bit. And so all of a sudden the Ozarks are on the national radar for bears.
Yeah.
And I think that's cool.
Yeah. And you're right. I'll admit, I didn't know that, they were on the national bear radar until today. But one of the things I've noticed through the years is, you know, regions sort of come into vogue and then they slip back into the background. They come back and it's kind of a cyclical thing. And, you know, if you go back to the 60s and 70s, the Ozarks and the 1960s and 70s, the Ozarks were really hot. You had the Beverly Hillbillies and you had all these folk festivals going on around the region. And there was a lot of stuff, the Ozark Mountain Daredevils, you know, one of my favorite bands from the 70s and a lot of stuff. And then the region sort of disappeared and then And I think you're exactly right. In the just in the last decade, it's really made a comeback on TV and the movie Winter's Bone, a terrific novel and movie that came out a few years ago, set in the sort of meth cooking element of the Ozarks, and so I think you know this resurgence of bear hunting and interest in bear hunting is perfect. And at least as far as I'm concerned, there's no better headquarters than the Ozarks for that, from the history, from the history that I know about, that's a pretty perfect place for it.
Well, the first book that I read of yours, I've got it right here in my hand, is, it's titled Arkansas, and there's two ways to spell it on the title. Arkansas, the historical way that ends with an S,
right?
And then Arkansas spelled with a W at the end.
The way we all say it.
That's in right. Arkansas. That's right. Yeah, we don't say Arkansas. We say Arkansas with a W.
Yeah.
And then the tagline, and this is what, man, you had me at this, which it may have been I may be the only person that ever read this book. I don't know. But how bear hunters, hillbillies, and good old boys defined a state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can see how that subtitle would get you.
It hooked me hard, man. Yeah. It hooked me hard.
Yeah.
And that's really what I want to talk about is like is how, you know, I'm interested in how me specifically how hunting culture influences a region.
Yeah,
you know, because I think what's happening inside of modern hunting is we're trying to redefine our relevance. You know, I mean, with a lot of things that happen, urbanization, people being disconnected from the land, disconnected from where they came from, anti-hunting sentiment, people just not understanding the culture. People are disconnected. So as hunters, it's kind of like we're trying to say, we know we're relevant. We know what we're doing is beneficial for wildlife, beneficial for economies, beneficial for non-game animals that we're not hunting because of funding for wildlife that we're trying to protect. So all these amazing benefits that come from modern hunting, but we're trying to like carve out our relevance in a modern time. And so when I look at a statement like that, how bear hunters, hillbillies, and good old boys defined a state, like I think really what I'm trying to do is I'm curious about how other parts of my life. And I told you right before we started this that I'm a seventh generation Arkansan. My kids are eighth generation. You know, we've really been hunters all the way through, and I'm trying to figure out where hunting has influenced my life in maybe ways that I don't even understand. You know,
right, right.
And
I think there's a lot to that. As you were talking, I was thinking about. A lot of things that have happened just in the 21st century, these sort of revivals. And in a way, I think what you're talking about is sort of a hunting revival in a sense. And I think about these, you know, this fad for what we call it, axe throwing or whatever, thing is. And a lot of these, and I think I know there's here, in the, you know, 20 years into the 21st century, there's a renewed interest in going back to the land amongst, you know, a younger generation again. And I think a lot of that is a reaction to the fact that our society is so urbanized and it's modernized and it's gotten farther away from that, you know, that past that many of us probably romanticized to a certain degree, that sort of hunting and farming close to the land past that people are trying to reconnect with. And sometimes it's people who've been away from the land for a generation or two, and they feel some sort of, some sort of emptiness or some sort of vacuum that needs to be filled by making contact with the land, whether that's, you know, growing their own food or right. killing their own food or whatever that is. So I think it's all part of part of the primitivist spirit. And okay. I don't want to get, you know, too far into lengthy words here, but I think primitivism is a very strong force in human society, especially in civilized human society, that extends well beyond this kind of stuff. It's in religion and politics and all that kind of stuff. Mm. It's a desire to reconnect with your origins in a very real, you know, just a very hands in the dirt sort of way. And I think this
is that a feature of a really modern prosperous society?
I think it is. Yeah.
I mean, like the people back in the 1800s that were farming and bear hunting, like you said, we romanticize that so much. They sure as heck weren't trying to reconnect with their past. They're trying to get away from it. Is that right?
That's exactly right. I mean, that's the insight right there. It's
this next excerpt is from a fellow Arkansan by the name of Keith Sutton. The episode was 94, and it's called A Gunfight, A World Record Ray, and Mauled by a Bison. I didn't know Keith real well when I sat down to talk with him, but as he spoke, I realized what a unique man I was sitting with, and he had some incredible stories of adventure, and this just stood out to me as a really unique conversation when he talked about catching a world record ray in the Amazon River.
You know, people always asked about Brazil. Weren't you scared being in those remote places? I was never scared. It was totally the opposite, really. Mm. I'm scared going downtown Little Rock at night, but I'm not scared being on the Amazon 600 miles from the nearest town because there's nobody there.
Yeah,
that's what made it exciting. You're in a place few people visit, few people are there, few people live there. And so you have all these amazing opportunities, especially fishing-wise, that are just incredible. Mm. And I never felt in danger. I mean, we saw things that could have been dangerous. We saw 15-foot anacondas and things like that. But I never felt like we were ever in any danger down there. I loved going to Brazil. The people down there are really wonderful, and there's nowhere in the world got better fishing. I mean,
is that right?
It's incredible. Peacock bass. At the time, nobody was really promoting the catfishing down there. And I didn't know my first trip down there that there were huge catfish.
Really?
And when I found out, it's like, why am I fishing for peacock bass when I can catch a 600-pound?
Give me some chicken liver and a treble hook.
Exactly. So my second trip, on my first trip, something happened that was kind of incredible. I was in the boat with a friend from Brazil, and we saw this massive fish that was probably 7 or 8 feet across, round as a circle, that swam under the boat. And I'm like, what the heck was that? And he called it a haya. And I didn't know what that meant at the time, but it means ray.
Oh.
But it was 7 or 8 feet around. And they had those in freshwater.
You weren't close to the ocean?
No, nowhere close.
Freshwater ray.
We were 3,000 miles from the ocean.
Oh, wow.
And so when I got back, I started trying to find out what could that be. Nobody knew. There was no information about a fish like that. So I decided, I know where I saw it. I'm going to go back and try to catch it. So my second trip, I went
send an Arkansas
back.
Boy named Catfish down there to do a man's job.
I went to the same place, my second trip, and I caught that fish.
No way.
And it's called a discus ray. It had not been seen or described since the early 1800s. And it turns out there's more of them than people really knew.
How did you catch it?
Well, I figured it's a ray. I'd caught a lot of big rays in saltwater.
Okay, so you knew something about catching rays.
I'd caught southern stingrays that were 7 or 8 feet across, and they lay on the bottom and eat dead stuff. So I put a dead fish on the hook, threw it out on the bottom where I'd seen this fish before, and within 15 minutes, I had it on
my line. No way. Why didn't something else eat? I mean, like, if those fish, rivers are so full of fish, I mean,
it's pretty amazing. It's difficult fishing with those kind of baits, but I was just determined, you know, I was going to try to hit the right spot, and just fortunately, I caught it, and it was like the most incredible fish I've ever seen. When I got back, I decided, well, it needs to be a world record. I wanted to enter it in the record book, and you have to have the fish identified by an expert. I couldn't find an expert who knew what it was. I had all these great photos of this fish. Mm. None of the ray experts had ever heard of it. Finally, I found a guy in Germany who's a ray expert, and he said, this fish is painted in a book from the very early 1800s. It's the same fish, I have no doubt. In this book, it was called a spine-tailed Eleposaurus. And the picture was identical. It had a short tail covered with spikes a dinosaur.
You got to show me this picture.
Yeah, for sure. It's it was an incredible fish, and it's still the world record. That particular fish was about 6 feet across, weighed almost 200 pounds, and I caught several more while I was down there.
Really? I can't even imagine reeling in a fish like that. Like, did they fight?
Oh, yeah.
Or is it like dragging dead
weight?
Well,
it's kind of like dragging a barn door, you know. It's like most rays, you know. A lot of people who hook a ray here in saltwater just want to cut the line because it's so difficult to actually land one. You know, they're huge and they're flat and they suck up on the bottom and don't want to come up. This one was on the bottom in 8 feet of water. I had to sit there and strum my fishing line to make him mad enough to get off the bottom. And
so what do you mean, like vibrate the fishing line?
Yeah, you kind of vibrate your line like a guitar string and it aggravates them and they'll eventually come up.
I'll be darned. And, is that a ray trick or just a
that's a ray trick.
Fishing trick.
That's a ray trick that I learned in Virginia with some anglers out there. But when it came up, then I knew I had him. And it was an incredible fish. No, they don't eat them at all. I wanted to release this fish alive, but by the time we could get it weighed, I took a certified scale with me. By the time we could get to the boat, it had expired, so we couldn't release it.
Yeah.
And I asked, you know, can you eat it? And they're like, no, we're not going to eat that. The piranhas ate it, which was pretty incredible, too. All the anglers on the boat came and watched, and we cut it up and fed it to the piranhas.
Wow.
And that was pretty incredible.
That's an incredible story. Say the name of that fish again.
Well, now discus ray is the name. And before, there had been some small ones in the record book, I think. 11 pounds, something like that.
Oh, prior to you catching this one.
Yes, but they were small fish.
And the first one you caught was 200 pounds.
Yeah, almost 200 pounds. It was, the whole story was really incredible because it was such a rarity to be able to find something nobody knew anything about. I was just dumbfounded when I got back and I'm talking to all these
what year would that have been?
I can't remember for sure, but I believe it was 2001.
Maybe. I mean, that's like, we're not talking about like the 1960s or something.
No,
I mean, so that's amazing to me that in 2001
You can still go to Brazil. My last trip, I went to the Xingu River in Brazil, which is in a different area. And we actually caught some catfish there that had never been described by science at all.
Wow.
I came back with photos of fish that I needed to get identified, and I found an expert in Massachusetts at Cambridge University who spent his lifetime down there studying fish. And he found out I was going down there. He learned about this big ray, and he said, if you go to Brazil and you can photograph fish, send me the pictures. I'd like to see what you're catching. And it turned out some of the fish we caught had never been described by science. The local people knew about them, but science didn't know about them. They didn't have a name. A lot of them were unusual armored catfish. So, I mean, to imagine you can go out in this day and age and catch something science doesn't know about, to me, that's incredible.
It's fun. If you think about it, though, we live in such a unique time as humans because 75, 80, 100 years ago, that would have been kind of normal, maybe.
That's what we think, anyway.
Normal in the sense of so much had yet to be discovered. Right. But in the last 100 years, it's like all of a sudden we're sitting in your living room in Arkansas and we've got the world at our fingertips and we feel like everything's been discovered.
And it hasn't. And to me, that was always one of my things I loved doing the most was finding what's out there. Here in Arkansas, even, I found things over the years nobody knew was here in Arkansas. Salamanders and birds and snakes even that nobody knew were here.
Like what?
They're kind of obscure animals, but there was a type of worm snake I found when I was
they didn't know it was here.
Nobody knew it was here. And back then, I would publish those findings in scientific journals so people would know. There was a salamander called a mole salamander. Nobody knew we had those here. Even today, if you dig and read on the internet, every year there's literally hundreds of animals being discovered nobody knew about at all. I just did an article recently about just new fish that have been discovered every year.
Like worldwide?
Yes.
Okay.
And every year there's several hundred new species being described.
Wow.
So we're learning more and more. A lot of it has to do with DNA and genetics. Right. We're finding out fish that we thought were all one type of fish are really several species.
I see.
But sometimes it's something brand new we didn't know about. And
yeah.
To me, those adventures when I was able to find something nobody knew about, that's the coolest thing in the world.
That really is.
It's really fun.
That really is. This next excerpt is from episode 92 when I talked to Steve Rinella and Giannis Poutelis. There's some guys I look up to, and I think you'll enjoy this little snippet of the conversation. I just had a few just quick, I'm going to run through these questions and then we'll be done. So these are unanswered questions that people have about celebrities. I'm a little leery to use the word celebrity because we don't really want to say that.
Do we count as that?
I'm not sure. But I asked a few people and they were joking, but they were serious. Question number one, and you could just give a short answer. Are you nice to your wife? We'll start with Giannis.
Extremely.
He is. It just depends for me, man. I mean, you know, my wife's mad at me a lot. I'm mad at my wife a lot. We've been together 12 years, man. We got three little kids in the house. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that, right?
You're not going to paint a super rosy picture.
It's like
here.
A bottomless
but level. Your intentions.
There's a tremendous amount of love and respect, and I would never do anything to disrespect my wife.
Yeah.
But it's just like anybody knows, man. Like, you get a kids. You spend a lot of time on each other's nerves. And I don't like to act like it's not. It's just a reality, man.
Yeah.
But, it's all based on respect and love, but God, it just gets stressful sometimes.
Okay.
What I like to make sure that I do, and again, I answered that question, you know, quickly so you could get through these questions quickly, but since we're getting into them, I try to at least when I am to then be humble and apologize.
There you go.
And know that.
Hey, Giannis speaks very highly of you behind your back. About your being a father and husband.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, I'd do a little checking around.
You did some reference checking.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Number two, what do your wives think about all this? Like, just you guys, like traveling, hunting, you know,
me real quick, there was never a knot. There was never like, it wasn't like a thing that got introduced.
Right.
It was just always that way.
Yeah.
It was always that way. So I never had to go through a hurdle of being like, hey, I have a new lifestyle.
You didn't start it. Okay. No. That makes sense. Giannis?
It very much was introduced. We've been married now 17 years. And so halfway through this thing kind of started, and I started traveling a whole bunch more. Although we had always been apart some because I was a hunting guide and would be gone for most of the fall. And she spent a lot of time in the field all summer. So she would be sometimes gone in a different state for 3 months. Yeah, she's very supportive of whatever I do. And, it's also, a source of income, and it's nice to be able to do something you love to do, for your income. So
yeah,
can't say no to that.
Okay. So Meteor was built on this authenticity inside of a context in the hunting world that had lost a lot of authenticity. And so the question is, and that's what would characterize you, Steve, and Giannis too, and just kind of the brand I feel like is authenticity. And so how do you maintain that authenticity in the midst of massive growth when we know, like everybody knows that consumes hunting media, that it has to be paid for? I mean, so what stole authenticity?
No, they don't know that.
You don't think so? I mean, what stole authenticity?
That really irritates people.
Well, is that guys were...
Especially when you're in the business of providing, like, basically, like, free media. Like,
right.
Podcasts are free, right? I mean, there's an advertising component, but you're like, yeah, producing, like, free media. Netflix, you know, it's not free, but it's a very low subscriber fee. It's it's a bottomless pit of content.
Right.
Right? Like, you know, I don't... It's not transactional per episode. However, people are very irritated when confronted with the idea that you need to finance the operation.
Right, right.
That you need to finance your ability to make free content. Yeah. I get it.
Yeah.
But people know it's not understood. I don't think it's widely understood.
Well, so how do you maintain? Because I mean, what I was saying was that you've done a good job of maintaining that authenticity inside of the context. So how do you keep doing that? Hey, let me, I digress to,
Hold on a minute, but go ahead. I think the questions, you kind of, the question's like there, but it's eluding you.
Okay. Well, that's the question. How do you build a business like you have and maintain the authenticity that got you here? I mean, I think it's the essential question.
Because it'd be like, let's say you make shoes, okay, and you make good shoes, and then pretty soon you have a big company that makes shoes. People aren't going to say to you, how do you continue to make shoes? Be like, well, that's what we do.
Well,
so I'm saying, like, what created the situation anyways is just
still what's created.
It's just like making a thing that was making a thing that felt real and you could feel passionate about. If you stop doing that, you've stopped making shoes.
Do you see that happening, you know what I'm saying, with other people? I see what you're saying.
Like, what is it? If you're not doing that anymore, then you're not doing the thing that
right,
that people wanted anyway.
But do you not see that that's what happens to companies, though, is they lose that when they get big? And that's certainly not what I'm saying. I'm seeing.
Well, they might, but I don't know how you keep. Yeah, I don't know. I can't really. Okay. I can't.
Well, I think in our context, though, in the hunting industry, I think maybe what you're getting at is that because of the way that you have to pay to make this stuff keep working, right? You have partnerships and advertisers, and you have to make them happy. Right. And so at some point, you come up to a thing where there's a huge check that's associated with maybe a product or a brand that you don't align with. But if you need that check real bad, you have to go that route, right? And then you end up endorsing maybe a product or a brand that you necessarily don't align with, and people see that you are being inauthentic, and then it could cost you your authenticity.
Right. Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. Not like in the material you make, but
in a holistic place, and not just that, but yes, that.
Yeah. I mean, speaking to that, I think we've just always stood our ground, and when that stuff comes around, I mean, there's just boxes and boxes of gear that comes across through the doors of Meteor and across our desks where we just look at it and it's like, hey, it might be good, but it's just not us, you know? And we know we just pass on it. And we've, you know, speaking of Steve's loyalty, I mean, First Light was the first clothing brand that he got in with and been with them for 10 years now, you know?
Yeah, the first two people to get behind our show were First Light and Vortex.
Yeah.
And we, to this day.
Yeah, they're still there.
Yeah, but I think
to endorse, talk about, recommend Vortex products is not painful.
It's authentic because you've been using them for that long.
And I have there's a product connection, but I have an emotional connection there.
Yeah.
That's not all, you know, I don't want to tell you that's something that's like that emotional aspect is always present, but there's parts of it that I'm like quite proud of that fact.
Yeah.
I don't view that I'm able to have like a long-term relationship and a sponsorship arrangement, a reciprocal relationship with Vortex. I don't look at that as being like, oh, it's just a thing I had to do. I'm like proud of that.
Yeah. And see what I see is that I think there's an internal component inside of somebody that's got to be pretty strong to maintain that kind of authenticity in the midst of success. So, I mean, I guess, and maybe it's so deep inside of you guys that you don't even
That's not true, man.
You don't think so?
I don't want to like act like I don't understand your question. No, we have conversations all the time.
About what? What do you mean?
We have. What we do is deliberate.
Yeah.
It's not accidental. Okay? We have conversations every day about what, not like how to, what, not turning left or turning right, but it's like conversations every day about like getting it right.
Yeah.
Like getting it right. Detail. We did a hunt last year with these guys at this place called Crooked Sky Outfitters in Wyoming. Great dudes. Mm-hmm. Like, great, great dudes. Love those guys. And I was having a conversation with the son, Landon Peterson. And he was observing one day to me. He was, like, talking about how he observes. I would regard him like a successful person, right? Like, does things intentionally. And he was observing, he was telling me how he observes successful people. And he said a thing that he's noticed is that they pay attention to all the details. They pay attention to the details at their home. They pay attention to the details of how they raise their children. They pay attention to the details of what they do at work. They pay attention to the details of their vehicle. They like pay attention to the details. Always.
Yeah.
You can make a... There can be you can have a facade of carelessness or a facade of shooting from the hip. But I think that most people who are able to do something for a long time are very cognizant of details. And I think that we sit around arguing about that. People will be like, I cannot believe these people are arguing about something that seems so mundane.
Right.
It seems so silly. But we, like, as an organization or whatever, like, we don't think it's silly.
Yeah.
So when I say it's deliberate, there's like I'm like aware of what we do.
Yeah.
And how we do it. Not to say that, you know, you don't make all kinds of screw ups, but you know, we discuss things.
I like it. I like
at great length, things that would be silly.
Yeah.
When we're making our show, we argue over like seconds of things. Like really, like seconds, you know, considerable back and forth.
Lastly, how could we talk about the Bear Hunting Magazine podcast without including Ted Nugent's performance of Fred Bear? A highlight for sure.
We spent that last October together for about a week, and then the next spring he died in 88. And I went out to do my chores one day, and we were all shattered at his death. It was just unbelievable because he made such an imprint on everybody. He's just a great, great man. Did you ever meet him?
No.
Oh, well, you're going to meet him right now. And so I went out to do my chores. I had my dog biscuits, my Irish setters, and I went, porch. I went and I grabbed the guitar, and I had no idea. I wasn't thinking of Fred. I just sat down and I went. Now, I always play killer licks when I pick up the guitar, but I never played one like this before. There I was, back in the wild again. And I felt right at home, where I belong. And I had that feeling coming over me again. Just like it happened so many times before. So many times. The spirit of the woods is like an old good friend. Makes me feel warm and good inside. I know his name, it's good to see him again. 'Cause in the wind, he's still alive. Talking about Fred Bear, walk with me down the trails again. Take me back where I belong. Fred Bear, I'm glad to have you at my side, my friend. And I will join you on the big hunt before too long. And it was kind of dark. Another misty dusk. And it came from a tangle down below. And I tried to remember everything he taught me so well. I had to decide which way to go. Was I alone or in a hunter's dream? The moment of truth is here and now. I felt his touch, I felt his guiding hand. And the buck was mine forevermore. Because of Fred Bear, I still walk down those trails again. He takes me back where I belong. Fred Bear, I'm glad to have you at my side, my friend. And I will join you on the big hunt before too long. We're not alone when we're in the great outdoors. We got his spirit, We got his soul. And he guides my steps, guides my arrows home. The restless spirit forever roams, and it roams with Fred Bear when I walk down those trails again. He takes me back where I belong. Fred Bear, I'm glad to have you at my side, my friend. And I will join you on the big hunt before too long. 'Cause in the wind, he's still alive. In the wind, he's still alive. In the wind, I can hear, I hear Fred Bear. I hear you, Fred. Hey, Fred, let's go hunting, buddy. Come on. You go up that ridge. I'll go down to the swamp, baby. We'll get that buck.
I hope you've enjoyed these highlights from the Bear Hunting Magazine podcast over the last couple of years. These were all special moments that were memorable to me, and they most certainly were not all the special moments. Holy cow. Every single episode, every single guest had extreme value to bring to our listeners. Thank you. Thank you for your support of Bear Hunting Magazine and our podcast and what we're doing. I hope you have a great Christmas. I hope you stay safe. I hope you have a great new year. You'll hear from us again, but it might be in a condensed version in the next podcast. Merry Christmas, boys and girls. Have a good one.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.